Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
And a very good evening. You are very welcome to Game On. It is Monday, November 22nd. Thank you very much to Jenny and the team for the last couple of hours. Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, Alan Cawley and David Connolly are with us to discuss what next at Manchester United as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer departs with his heart on his sleeve.
You know we're better than this. We've not been able to show it. But go out, chest out, enjoy being a Man United player. Champions League, the biggest stage. If and when you win the game, you're through to the next round. Michael's going to be in charge. Michael's, I've got the utmost respect. I love Michael to bits. Becoming emotional now because he's top. And they'll be fine. I'll watch them and support them.
I think if everybody walked away with such dignity, the world would be a better place. But in rugby, we've Stephen Ferris on a France-New Zealand test for the ages and Ireland's clean sweep.
Far side now as it's back with James Ryan. James Ryan and Ireland now within 3 yards of the Argentinian line. Swept back towards Caelan Doris. Caelan Doris bounces off two of them, and Caelan Doris uses his upper body strength to blast his way over, just coming towards half-time. And that was really good continuity work for Ireland.
We will get Ruby's thoughts on a busy weekend of racing. If you want to get in touch, you can text us. Our number is 51551, or you can tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
So, Damien, it's good to have you in the hot seat tonight, but it's the man sitting opposite that really wants to get talking. I have no doubt he's been predicting this for weeks now, shouting and roaring it from the rooftops, I suppose. The best way of putting it, Alan Cawley, you've wanted him gone. Now he's gone. Such a nice man. How do you feel?
Yeah, Ruby, obviously I've been consistent on this for quite some time, but I wouldn't be one for basking in someone else's demise, and certainly that's not the case. I'm only here to do a job and give me view and give me an opinion, and an honest one, and I've been saying this for quite a long time because for me it's been sticking out like a sore thumb. Ever since he was in the job, really, he was brought in on a temporary basis, as we all know, did quite well in terms of lifting spirits, but for anybody to think that he was the future and he was the long term manager, or he was the one to bring success back to Old Trafford and take over from the likes of Liverpool, Man City, Chelsea, whoever the case may be, and topple the likes of a Guardiola or a Klopp, they were deluded. And anybody who thought that, they were obviously led by maybe some blind optimism or blind loyalty towards the fact that he was a legendary player and a legendary figure that played at the club, and that'll never be taken away from him. And he was that great figure and that goal in terms of scoring the winning goal from the Champions League. But his tenure as Man United, and I've heard a lot of discussion about this over the weekend, obviously, and everybody having their tuppence worth on it and people talking about progress being made and he's done a good job. Well, I can't see anything of the sort. They're so far behind Man City, so far behind Liverpool, so far behind Chelsea. And then, as you mentioned, I suppose, in the intro there about him going out with dignity. And he is a nice man. And obviously, he seems to be a nice man. And that's always been the case all along. And he's held himself and conducted himself quite well. But that's part of the problem, probably, is his niceness. Harry Maguire got sent off at the weekend. He made him captain. And he held his hand out and almost clapped him off, like gave him a bit of a high five. I couldn't believe him doing that. And then the interview yesterday, and by all accounts, he wanted to do that interview. And for me, the interview was absolutely desperate as well. So I'm not surprised to see him gone. Obviously, as I said, it's very sad in terms of you don't want people to see them losing their job. But for anybody to think he was ever going to take Man United back to the heights that they once were, it was never, ever going to happen.
I think I was one of those people, Alan. Maybe I was hoping Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, being a United hero, would come and rescue us. Blind faith, probably?
Yeah, possibly, Ruby, and maybe, I suppose, if you were to speak to fans about it, they were probably hoping that would be the case because of the brilliant career that he had as a player, and as you said, he does come across and seem like a really genuine, nice man, absolutely. So I say people were probably pulling for him a bit more than maybe an outsider. But I think that's been part of the problem as to why he's held on so long as well, in terms of the fact that he is the legendary figure. If he was an outsider, he would have been sacked a long time ago. I don't think he even would have got the job in the first place. And obviously you have to maybe look at in terms of the boardroom and what's going on there, and there seems to be major trouble and issues there as well. But for them to make the decisions that they've made and in initially giving him the job, that was a huge mistake, purely off the back of some good vibes and some positive results or a bit of positivity around the place. So that was a huge error on their part. And now that they have sacked him, and what astounds me really for a club of that level and a club of that size, and you look at the last few results, they've obviously lost 5 games out of the last 7. How a club of that stature haven't been planning or haven't made a contingency plan for when to do sack him and have nobody lined up, and to be talking about bringing in an interim manager, whoever is going to take that, obviously Carrick's going to come in, and then possibly another one till the end of the season, and then look for the man that they want. It's just baffling and it's mind-boggling, and it tells you, I suppose, the ineptitude of what's going on at boardroom level as well, which is obviously separate to Solskjaer. So there's major problems at Man United. I never ever thought I'd see Man United in the state that they're currently in. I can't believe it's dropped so bad.
Okay, we're going to chat to David Connolly, who's with us in just a second as well, but before that, you've mentioned Michael Carrick. You kind of forget in all of this, United play Villarreal in the Champions League. The game will be half an hour old this time tomorrow. It's crucial that they get out of the group in the Champions League, and that's certainly no formality. So Michael Carrick was on press conference duty today in advance of that game, and here's his take on what's played out at Old Trafford in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, listen, we could sit and talk through all sorts of different things right now, but for me it's not to be looking back right now. I think of course I know in my own mind what I could have done better, what could have been improved. As Harry's already said, I think it's important that everyone looks at themselves and thinks what you can do better. It's easy to look elsewhere. And as a player, I was exactly the same. I think look at yourself first. What can you do better? What can you improve on? And what's next? And for me, what's next is we're just about to catch a flight to Spain and prepare the boys ready for the game tomorrow. That really is my focus. That's what I'm looking forward to, and I can't wait for the game to come round. Obviously, I've worked closely with Ollie for a long time now, and we do have very similar beliefs. We did as players, we certainly do as coach and manager. So, yes, of course, I've got my own personality and to Ollie, but it's just very similar because that's why we worked together for so long and worked together well for a period of time. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. I'm not giving too much away of what my plans are, but I'm very clear in my own mind what we want to do, how we want to play, how we want to go about it, and looking forward to seeing that on the pitch.
That's Michael Carrick chatting earlier. As mentioned, David Connolly is with us as well. Evening, David. How are you?
Good evening. Very good. You?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us as always. The lads have touched on it there. We can analyse Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to within an inch of his life. But when you look at it, this again points to a real failure at executive level at Man United since Ferguson went. You've got a situation where Solskjaer is gone, but Michael Carrick, Darren Fletcher, Mike Phelan, Kieran McKenna, Martin Pert and Eric Ramsey, who are his coaching staff, are all still in place. So there's a significant level of optics about all this, that they've got rid of the figurehead and they don't appear to have any plan with regard to where they're going to go next.
Yeah. Look, I've been a player at a lot of clubs where the manager has lost his job, and inevitably it would be the head or the manager, maybe his assistant that goes, and then the staff that's left over tide you over. Now, there's going to be an awful lot of attention on Michael, and I played with Michael Carrick, shared a dressing with him, room with him at West Ham. Fantastic player, quiet, very quiet, softly spoken. You wouldn't say, manager material yet. Is he the right man to lead United would be the next question, because obviously his credentials as a player we understand that, but in terms of leading a club like Man United and the players, I'm sure he'll have their respect, obviously, but nonetheless, you would have thought that they would have obviously had their next man lined up. I know there's been a lot of discussion about this, but obviously, and Alan touched on it, look at the impact, say, Tuchel's had at Chelsea, taken over a side where Lampard was leaking goals, and immediately he arrests that with the work on the training ground, animated. Jurgen Klopp, animated. Guardiola. I mean, Chelsea have conceded something like 4 goals. Man City, 6. United have conceded 21. There's only the 2 teams at the bottom, that have conceded more than them. So immediately, they obviously need a number one. And I can't fathom you know, that they haven't, obviously, they could have done that in the international break, obviously, but I think the result after that, post that, ruined the hope that maybe things could be arrested on the training pitch. And that was a worry, because you would have thought by now, you know, all the little issues that United have had in the last few months and last season haven't really been helped on the training ground. You know, and Michael's obviously been there a while. Kieran McKenna's been there a while. You know, obviously Mike Phelan, well-respected, has been there a while. So it seemed like it needed a clearing of the decks, and they either missed the boat. If they can get Poch, he would come in. You know, he likes to work with certain people. Paul Mitchell, who he had at Tottenham, who he had at Southampton before that. You know, he's his sort of man for recruitment. He's got his staff. You know, Antonio Conte's the same. But obviously they've missed Conte, and I guess, you know, everyone else who seems to be coveted is in a job. So now they've got a bit of a predicament, and whether Michael can get him over this line, because what you don't want is this to keep going, and Michael to be in charge for too long, because I think that it could get, not any fault of Michael's, but it could get worse.
Alan, what does Michael Carrick do? I mean, obviously, we've listened to David there. They're porous at the back. To me, you can point a finger at Maguire for that, and even his antics on Saturday when he got sent off and whipping off the armband. I wouldn't give it back to him if I was Michael Carrick. Would he be brave enough to do that?
No chance, Ruby. And that's part of the problem. I would echo everything that David has just said in terms of the coaching structure at the club, because you can arrest things. When you're conceding goals, you can sort things out. You can absolutely, by your work on the coaching pitch. But for them to be conceding goals and shipping goals in the manner that they have, and yet none of those issues addressed in how open they are in the games that they've played. And I'm not talking about the last four or five games in terms of Leicester, Liverpool, Man City against them teams. I go back to Newcastle on the opening day in the season when Sam Maximan was running amok, and he had three or four great chances. Everton should have beat them as well. Aston Villa, these teams, they were so open in them games as well, Ruby. So, and that's why I used to come on to you every Monday and say, this is so far gone, this is over. And you're asking the question in terms of what Michael Carrick does. Well, you would like to think he was contributing in the background, or maybe having a word with Solskjaer and seeing these things that we were all seeing. But to me, obviously, that hasn't been the case. And even just listening to Michael Carrick in that interview there as well, and he was a great player when he played, everybody knows that. But it sounds like a lot more of the same of what you're going to get with him taking over at the moment. And I'm so glad David brought up the fact that Tuchel as well. I've often mentioned here, Guardiola, Tuchel, Klopp, these are the best of the best. As you know, Ruby, in racing, there's levels in everything you do, and they're the best of the best. And for me, Man United should have a manager of the calibre of those, and managing the club with authority. That's Solskjaer's biggest problem. He was like a boy, indulging players, indulging Pogba, indulging these fellas, letting them walk all over him. As you says, Harry Maguire, he made him captain, and look at the reaction from Harry Maguire on Saturday. You could almost see he nearly got him to sack, and that was the response that he gave to a fella who gave him the opportunity to be the captain at Man United, a disgrace. So Solskjaer should have nailed some of these fellas long before him walking out the door, because he was always going to end up, he was the one that was going to lose the job. So you look at Michael Carrick at the moment, what's he going to do in terms of 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks? I'm not so sure. When you look at, and there's talk of people saying right off the season, it's only November. Tuchel went in at the end of January and won a Champions League. And look at them now at the moment. So he arrested the issues they were having in the space of 4 or 5 months. So there's plenty to be played for. There's plenty to be salvaged. But you need to go after the man now. And the problem, as Damian mentioned and alluded to in terms of the boardroom, because of the lack of planning and because of the lack of how they haven't anybody lined up because of the demise of Solskjaer and what's been happening in front of everyone, it baffles me.
Okay, let's hear from Harry Maguire, who was also out today.
Well, I think like Michael said, I think it's been a very hard time for us as players as well, because the amount of respect that we have for the boss and what he's done for a lot of us over the last 2.5 years period, which he's been here. We've been on a journey together. It's never nice to see someone lose the job, and for him to come in and speak to us yesterday, the emotion around the place, I think, it was difficult to be in, and I think all the lads, I think it showed as a group of lads how much we wanted to succeed. And I think, like you've said, the result on Saturday, it wasn't good enough. But the results of recent have ultimately not been good enough, and it's a result business. And unfortunately, Ollie's paid the price for that. And obviously, we've got to take a big responsibility of that as well.
David, just looking at the dynamics, you've got a situation where, you know,
they brought Jadon Sancho in the summer. They brought Varane in the summer. They brought Ronaldo in. You've got the Alex Ferguson is still like a shadow at the upper echelons of the club. You've got Ed Woodward as executive chairman, who, you know, I wouldn't trust him at this stage to run a corner shop, let alone run a business of this size. That if somebody comes into that job, there appears to be so many shadows and so many things hanging over you, you'd wonder realistically how attractive a job it is, unless they come in and say, right, we're getting rid of this, we're getting rid of that, we're getting rid of everything else, we'll put our director of football in place. And does it need a significant restructure in terms of how the club is run?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, you know, listening to Harry there, it sounded like a bereavement they were talking about. You know, in all honesty, it was too emotional. You have to take the emotion out of this, and it was obvious that the players and the manager were too close. There has to be that, I think, there has to be that little bit of distance. And I don't want to keep referencing others, but we're going to have to, because obviously you're comparing United to the best. Now, the best would be, if you look at, I worked on the Chelsea game at a weekend. Now, Ben Chilwell was someone who was put out of that side by the manager, and he laid down a challenge for him. You know, he left him, he was out, not in the Euros, weren't playing, and he laid him down a challenge. Now, Ben has responded, and maybe that's what some of these United players needed. They needed a challenge and going, right, you're out the team, you need to get back in it. And I looked at how Ben Chilwell's playing. He plays left wing back, but half the time he ends up as another centre forward. And, you know, the tactical awareness that Tuchel has brought into that team is what people are screaming out Ollie didn't bring to United for all their players. So you distill it all down, right? And obviously they haven't had their succession planning right. We know that. Is it too late? Is it too late for them? That's the issue. Well, if they went and got Pochettino, it wouldn't be, I don't think. It's just whether they can get him, because I think anyone else they get, anybody else, it won't be good enough, I don't think. But and you know, you can level trophies, etc., at Poch, but I think he's a top man. I left Southampton just when he came in. Some of the players I respect the most in the game say he is absolutely top. And I think if you got him at United, I think things would he's on a par. I think he's on a par with your getting to that level of Tuchel and Klopp and those sorts of people, absolutely. But they would need someone like him. I think anyone else, I can't see anyone else being good enough for United.
Two very quick questions. Like, are you going to walk away from PSG to take Man United over in its current state? And secondly, I want to get your opinion on that interview that Solskjaer did yesterday, because for me it was the most mortifying aspect of the weekend. But just Pochettino first, like, will, you know, do you walk away from the Galacticos of PSG to take over the basket case of Manchester United?
Yeah, I tell you why you would. I don't think, and you know, because, you know, I know a little bit about how Poch works, and I went back to Southampton after I left, you know, and I brought him a bottle of red wine, and I was in his office, and all the lads are telling me what he was like, and you know, and everything else. So I know how he works, right? And he works with his same staff. He likes a guy, Paul Mitchell, for recruitment, and he can work with that staff. He doesn't get on with Leonardo. I mean, that is a, you know, everybody knows that. Right now, you go to United, I think he'd have a lot more autonomy to do things how he wants with the players he wants. And I think at PSG, he's given players. Poch is not like that. He is not like that. And I think he's probably realised he might be in the wrong role. So I think if the United one come up, 100% he would take it, because I don't think the structure at PSG suits him. But I think he could make the structure at United, because I don't think the people above him, I think they'd let him. I think they'd allow him that, because it's not there at the minute, and it's in all the wrong order. They haven't got the right people in the right positions. I mean, Dan Fletcher, in all intents and purposes, he's not going to be able to tell Mauricio Pochettino how to do his job or what players he's going to work with, you know?
Alan, I think this is a conversation that's going to be having again next Monday and probably the Monday after, to Manchester United get a manager in charge, listening to what they've left in charge right now. But there are other clubs in the Premier League that are going in the right direction. Liverpool, Chelsea, Man City, they were dominant again the weekend. We'll start at Anfield, and Liverpool just ran Arsenal ragged, and without Ramsdale, it could have been any score.
Yeah, they were so impressive, Ruby. And look, you know my feelings on Klopp, and not to go back on the Solskjaer thing, but we've said this numerous times, and for all the tactical awareness that they have and how brilliant those managers are, the biggest thing for me with those three is the demands they put on the players and the authority that they have. And you look at, David used the example of Chilwell. They paid 50 million, I think, for Chilwell in the off season. Obviously, he comes in, maybe a bit of swagger about him, he's not performing, Tuchel, bang, out of the team. And that's exactly what they do. There's a fear factor, and that has to be there. Football is the most ruthless, most cutthroat industry out there, Ruby, and there has to be that fear factor.
That's every sport. That is every sport. William Mullins had to jock me off to get me to perform as well. That's just every sport. It's a given. And if a fella in charge can't stand you down, he shouldn't be in charge.
Exactly. At elite level sport, it's the most ruthless and cutthroat. And that's where Solskjaer went wrong on numerous occasions. He never nailed the players ever. There was no authority about him, indulged him. He was like a boy on the sideline. You look at the other three. I watched the game a couple of weeks back. Chelsea were 6-0 up and Tuchel's going bananas on the line. And it's not about ranting and raving. He's doing it for a reason in terms of the demands. Klopp's the same with his players. He gets the best out of him, Guardiola. But to go back to the game at the weekend, Liverpool were absolutely brilliant. I would have serious question marks still over Arteta. I know they were unbeaten in 10 going into the game, but and people were saying that that's a test in terms of we'll see where Arsenal are at. I think they played into Liverpool's hands in a lot of ways, particularly. And I know it's Arteta's way and his philosophy in terms of trying to play out from the back, but there's decision making to be made. And if you're getting overrun and overpowered by the best pressing team in Europe, you change your way. You don't keep making the same mistakes over and over. And the amount, I think there were 17 turnovers in all from Arsenal trying to play out from the back, which totally led into Liverpool obviously winning the ball so high up and attacking and being down the throat of them scoring. And Liverpool were just brilliant on the day.
David, the pace that Liverpool were able to counter-attack with, especially for the Mo Salah goal, like it was phenomenal. Just the one end of the pitch to the other.
Yeah, and, you know, Alan's touched on the ruthlessness. If you look at the touchline spat that happened between Klopp and Arteta. Now, anyone in football would tell you, Jurgen Klopp and his bench are probably the one of the most disliked in football. You know, they are horrible on that bench, you know, because they fight and kick and they want every decision. You see them snarling, you know, and that is what a lot of the other teams are looking for, the Uniteds are looking for. And that's how they played. 100%. Tempo was frightening. The pace they've got, the efficiency, the ruthlessness of them. And look, they're, you know, obviously they're a top team at this moment in time, you know, but obviously those three, them, Chelsea, Man City, they are streets, you know, streets ahead. Look what Chelsea did to Leicester. I mean, it was like men v boys. I mean, they made them look so average, and obviously they're not. You know, and you saw what Leicester did to United, but Chelsea just, you know, toyed with them. It was complete control, and that is the difference with those three. They're a class apart at the minute.
David, just on the Liverpool bench, is there a compliment in the back of all that? That's exactly what you want your bench to be. But
yes,
yeah,
yeah. Look, you look at them, you look at the Guardiolas of this world, you know, your Klopps, no backing down. They fight and scrap for everything, you know, they fight and scrap for everything. And yeah, there is 100%, there is not a backhanded compliment. That is what you want, you know, that is what you want. And that's how he manages, but he's always managed like that, you know, and Guardiola can be the same. So, there's a little bit of work. So, look, everyone manages differently. We understand that, like players. But nonetheless, you know, at the end of the game, you see him going on there, bear hugs to his players, you know, big, massive, beaming smile. But when that game is on, you know, everything else is off. It is all about the win. And the little decisions you need all along the way. You know, they're awful with the fourth official. You want to see him in the fourth official. I mean, you know, and that breeds influence as well. And he knows that. And that is astute management, you know, influencing the fourth official, everything on the sidelines. You get the crowd up. You know, suddenly things turn because of the crowd. You're harnessing their energy. And look, Klopp is extreme. He tries to play that he's not smart because he's got amazing coaches for, you know, Michael Beale. He's got a throwing coach. He praises all these other coaches. Like he is obviously super intelligent. You know, super intelligent. He knows exactly what he's doing all the time.
You look, Damien, as well, in terms of people on paper might say Bruno Fernandes, Pogba, these type of players, household names, superstar names, whatever the case may be. Liverpool, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Milner, Henderson, Naby Keita. Klopp wouldn't indulge a Bruno Fernandes or a Pogba probably. A reflection of the demands that he puts on in terms of that dressing room, Henderson, what they're driving for. It's the character of those players that he would much rather over a talent of a fella showing up once every 4 weeks. Whereas he knows every week that if he puts in a Henderson or a Milner, who might not have the name of a Pogba or Fernandes, but he gives them 8 out of 10 every week.
David, before we let you go, I know you've not been on since the culmination of the World Cup qualification campaign. What's your considered take on Ireland now that we've reached the end of that? And I'm sure it's not something that gets massively spoken about in England, but there's a big roaring debate going on here as to whether or not Stephen Kenny should be given a contract extension now, or should they hold off until he's taken charge of the six games that remain between now and next July?
Well, you know my thoughts on here, because I've been on a few times, and when things were desperate, I remember coming on, you know, at their lowest ebb, and you could see green shoots of recovery, and there has been that, you know. So I thought it was a really good end, and I know, you know, Liam Brady, and you have a couple of others that obviously might think a little bit differently. I think what the FAA can't afford to do is make another mistake in terms of giving someone a contract and then having to pay them off. I don't think that's going to be the case with Stephen. I think he's laid really good foundations, very young team who all believe and buy into it. They fight, they battle, they scrap, they showed some quality in the last few games. They got the goals that they deserve, they show character. You know, they've had a little bit of heartbreak as well, if you remember the Portugal game late on. And, you know, I'm really on with Stephen, and for the last few months it was all about, you know, can you see signs of things progressing, improving? Yes, you could, and now finally you're seeing the fruits of that labour, you know, and I think they'll only get better. So in terms of the contract, I probably would give him one. I probably would, and I know the games and the wins might not be the ones that they wanted, but, you know, and obviously we haven't maybe finished, but look, we finished above Luxembourg, and that was probably as good as it could come after the initial start. And I think you got to back him. I would give him it.
David Connolly, thanks very much for joining us. Alan Colley would be delighted with you back, and Stephen Kenny, we're going to take a quick break.
Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on. Rugby.
Welcome back to Game On, and as the Sting said, we are going to talk about rugby, and I'm delighted to say that Stephen Ferris has joined us on the line. Stephen, thanks for taking our call. I'm not overly certain where to start, because from an Irish point of view, this was an autumn international series that's all positive. So you can pick up wherever you like.
Well, it's great that it's positive, isn't it? I think too many years gone by that we've always been focusing on the negatives, but not too many negatives to come out of this last 3 weeks, you know, getting off the fantastic start against Japan, racking up 60 points. And I think even the Japan versus Scotland game put that result into a little bit more perspective, that Ireland were phenomenal on that day. Scotland proved, I think it was 29-20, they beat Japan, and Ireland really put them to the sword in week one, and they just kicked on from that. A memorable performance against the All Blacks, huge physicality, and then just rounding it all off with a good performance. A good few changes actually as well, due to lads having to fall out, injuries to Ian Henderson before the match, and they fitted in, slotted in really, really well. And you know, I think Argentina, they ran out of gas a little bit towards the end of the match, but Ireland played what was in front of them and done it very, very well.
Yeah, it was a change in the style of play, and a lot of players stepped up to the mark, and there was different positions. You were wondering who'll step in, will someone make that their own? Obviously Porter at open side, Kelleher, Furlong. We've a front row now that looks like it picks itself every day.
Yeah, I think Kelleher for me is probably the standout. You know, his position at hooker, it wasn't always guaranteed. Rob Herring had done a good job over the last couple of years. He's very, very accurate when it comes to his line-out throwing. And I think when it comes to set-piece in the big games, you rely on it so heavily. But his line-out throwing was pretty good, pretty consistent throughout. But it's his physicality. He's found himself on the wing a couple of times, breaking tackles, getting offloads away. You know, that line-out, or was not a lift, or a line-out lift, it was the off the restart where he hoisted Peter O'Mahony above his head. Like, I know there's a few of those shots going around on social media. He really is playing some outstanding rugby. So he keeps himself fit. He'll be thereabouts again in the Six Nations, and with Porter and Furlong alongside him, that's a formidable front row.
And we have a beautiful second row when you look at it. We'd obviously James Ryan and Tadhg Byrne against Japan. It was Ryan and Henderson against the All Blacks. It was Byrne and Ryan and then Byrne and Baird yesterday, or Sunday even. They're four phenomenal players to have to pick from as your back row.
Second row, Ruby. Yeah, they're all playing good rugby too. They seem full of confidence and different line-out callers as well. I think that's the most impressive thing.
Henderson, he was calling against the All Blacks. Tag Byrne was calling at the weekend. I was down pitch side. And yeah, everything ran really smoothly. They're bringing huge physicality when it comes to carrying the ball, the work rate off the ball, getting around the corner, being options as well. I'm very comfortable with the ball in hand, and I think that's the most impressive thing for me is that 1-23, it doesn't really matter who's on that team sheet, they're all comfortable with ball in hand. And in Ireland teams years gone by, Ruby, you know, that certainly wasn't the case. So it's really refreshing to see.
Stephen, just I had the misfortune of sitting directly in front of Stephen pitchside yesterday, but you know, we didn't fall out, and we had a bit of crack. But come here, just how, you know, we went into this series slightly worried about where some of the Irish players might be at in terms of game time and freshness. We come out of it, and there's questions being asked just about where maybe some of the Southern Hemisphere teams were at in terms of fatigue and a long year ahead. Overall, how do you balance it up, and how do we ensure now that we drive on? And we're as competitive as England and France, who looked equally as impressive when the Six Nations rolls around in February.
Yeah, some really good points there, Damien, in the question. And I think there does need to be a little bit of perspective put into the last 3 weeks. You know, we shouldn't get carried away with ourselves. I know, you know, it's a typical Irish thing to do is to shout the house down and think we're, you know, the favourites now to win the 2023 Rugby World Cup. But I think the All Blacks, what it was, 14 test matches in the last few months. Argentina, you know, they looked like a beaten horse, didn't they, very early on in that game. And Japan, you know, they lost the run on themselves, and Ireland just ground them down. But I think it's the style of rugby. It's a huge positive to come out of the last 3 weeks. Moving the ball from width to width. The wingers seeing plenty of the ball. James Lowe and Andrew Conway have been outstanding. You know, long gone the days of watching Tommy Bowe just chasing box kicks all day long, and you know, I'm sure it was very frustrating times back then, even though the game plans worked and forcing the opposition into making lots of mistakes. But it just seems to be now backing yourself to make the right decisions. And as I said to Ruby there, it doesn't matter if you're number four in your back or you're Johnny Sexton at out half. They're all capable of putting somebody through a hole or creating an opportunity. So I think that's a huge positive. It's the style of rugby, the Andy Farrell way. And now it's up to teams, Damien, to try and stop it. And that's going to be tough.
There was a good article in one of the papers yesterday about the importance of Stuart Lancaster as well, that there's a real hallmark. And I know there was criticisms the initial weeks, that the first two games, about it being a Leinster-heavy team. But if that's to become the foundation upon which you build the national side, and it's to the greater good of the jerseys, the green jerseys when they have them on, there's no real shame in that, is there?
No, definitely not. And like, if I was picking the Ireland team going into that Japan game in week one of the autumn campaign, I probably would have picked the 12 Leinster players that were starting that match anyway. And, you know, that's me with my Ulster cap on and wanting to see more of the Ulster lads get down there. But, you know, they were playing the better rugby. There's an opportunity this weekend getting into the URC with Ulster obviously visiting Leinster. I'm sure a few of the Ulster boys can't wait to get warmed up for that one. The style of rugby that Leinster are playing is certainly filtering into the way Ireland are playing. And as an Irish fan, Damien, long may that continue.
Stephen, why do you think that yesterday's game reverted back to all tries from the forwards? There wasn't the same width on the game maybe that we'd seen the week before or against Japan. Why would that have been?
Ruby, it's as simple as this. It was too easy to get over the gain line. Like, you know, they didn't have to go to width. They were busting holes, one out runners even close to the line. I know a lot of the tries, a couple of pick and goes, you know, Tag Byrne going straight through and just reaching out an arm. You know, they tried to do that on several occasions against the All Blacks and were just getting hammered at the line. And when they played with more width against the All Blacks, that's when they looked more dangerous. But it was just too easy against Argentina. And I think that's a simple answer for you, Ruby, is that, you know, when you get a bit of change out of something, you just keep on banging at it. And that's what they've done. And all the forwards got on the score sheet. I think Josh van der Fleer was excellent once again. He's had a brilliant autumn series, the whole back row in general. And it's good to see the likes of young Dan Sheehan as well getting an opportunity, a great couple of carries in the game and getting over for another try. So, yeah, it's looking good.
Stephen, just let's go away then from being all positive. Andy Farrell, players always talk about the work-ons, and when it comes time to review these games, and I presume Andy Farrell and his coaching staff have already begun that process, are there still areas that you'd like, or what are the areas, there's always going to be areas, what are the areas you'd still like to see some level of development or focus on from Ireland to continue that upward trend?
For me, going into that match on Saturday, I think it was more squad depth. I think the style of rugby that they're playing and the way they're going about their business on the pitch, it's been pretty flawless over the last 3 weeks. And yes, of course, the opposition dictates what you're going to be up against. And I think Japan and Argentina did fall off the wagon a bit. But yeah, I would have loved to have seen Simon Zeebo get an outing. He now finds himself playing for Munster this weekend in South Africa. I know Gavin Coombs, he was sick for the first couple of weekends, I believe, and he hasn't found himself wearing the green jersey. Joey Carvey looked really good at fullback when he was switched there. So I just think I would have loved another game, this weekend for Ireland to filter in those players and see what they're made of. So it's just about continuing, I suppose, Andy, when he's talking about work-ons, for me, it's just about making that squad get bigger and bigger. And, if you do suffer one or two key injuries at a Rugby World Cup, that you're not scraping the barrel and you're able to rely on lads that have been there and done it in the big games. And, going forward, hopefully some of those guys that I mentioned get more game time in the bigger fixtures.
Stephen, for me, just as a fan looking in, watching the game, and rugby has taken its fair share of criticism with head injuries and huge tackles, but when you're spreading the ball and playing it the way Ireland were playing it, trying to run round players instead of through them, it looked a fraction easier to watch. There wasn't the same ferocity in the collisions. Could that be a way forward for rugby to deal with the, I suppose, criticism it's getting for the injury rates it has?
Yeah, off the back of the Lions tour, let's call a spade here. It was very boring, very one-dimensional. Of course, there was huge physicality and lots of bruised and battered bodies after that. But I just can't see Ireland letting it go. They're a good side, playing really good rugby at the minute, and having plenty of width in the ball is creating so many headaches for the opposition. So it's one of those things, Ruby, that I just love to see Ireland throwing the ball around, and hopefully that continues to do so.
Just, I know the page will be turned very, very quickly, and you mentioned there, what is it, two rounds of URC now before we head into the Champions Cup. So it's the flip of what we're traditionally used to in terms of Europe being the springboard into the internationals. Just a word on Munster. I feel so sorry for someone like Simon Zeebo and Gavin Coombs, who've spent so long in Ireland camp, haven't got any games, and now have to head to South Africa. And certainly the rumour mill, if you believe the Jungle Telegraph, is that a couple of the lads who've been in international camp could find themselves in South Africa, yes. And I'm just thinking that must be a nightmare trip for them when you consider that the other provinces are largely playing games amongst themselves.
Yeah, as a player, you wouldn't be that happy, would you? Putting your heart and soul into an international camp for 3 or 4 weeks and then having to, at the end of it, jump on a plane and go and play against the South Africans on their home soil. And that's very, very tough. But, there's experienced players there. Simon Zeebo's very experienced. He knows that when he's in that Irish camp, it's all about making sure that Irish team functions really well. And I think that's something that Andy Farrell's done really well also, is getting the best out of his players, not only the 23 on the pitch, but the other lads who are around those 23, to make sure that they're training well, training hard, training for each other. And yes, it is difficult when you have to split up and go your separate ways, but that's why the coaches get paid top money, to select the right players to come in and make sure that environment is working well for everyone.
And just briefly on that, I would imagine, I know even from chatting to yourself and Tommy, who were there yesterday, straight away the concern from an Ulster perspective was Ian Henderson, and whether or not he'll be fit in particular for that Claremont game and Northampton the week after that. You do start to worry about the cost on the provinces now, particularly when you don't have much margin for error in those opening two rounds of Europe.
No, definitely not. And I was going to say Dwayne Vermeulen as well, he's supposed to be playing next week, but oh no, of course not, he's away, he's playing for the Barbarians. We'll be missing Ian Henderson as well from an Ulster perspective, and even James Ryan, even though with a bit of a head knock or an injury against Argentina. So, yeah, the injuries do pile up, and it always seems to be in the last game of the autumn there before they head back to their provinces that there's a few niggles here and there. But Ian Henderson certainly looked in a bit of pain when he came out. He was sitting beside us, Damien. He was very heavily strapped, so that looks like if it's a hamstring issue, probably 4 to 6 weeks that he's going to be out. He's obviously the Ulster captain. That's not ideal, so it's about figuring out these headaches for Dan McFarland, because it's not Andy Farrell's problem really now as the boys head back to the provinces.
Obviously the All Blacks left Dublin last week and went to Paris, and I'm sure they're delighted to be heading to Auckland today, but it was a really entertaining match to watch. I mean, what about DuPont on Entomac? It was brilliant to watch.
Oh, it was quality. Yeah, and you just didn't want the game to end, so you didn't. It was end-to-end stuff. I thought the All Blacks were going to come back and, you know, find that purple patch that and just keep it going and going, but they didn't, and France turned them around once more. And young Entomac at out half, you know, what a class player he is. You talk about Ireland putting width in the ball and playing with flair. You know, that young man has it all. So, the big forwards as well, they certainly fronted up, provided a good front foot ball for the outside backs. And I'm looking forward to seeing France, how they cope in the Six Nations. And I think they're going to be the favourites for the bookmakers, really.
I'd say they would too. I mean, do you watch it, even like when Smith knocked on for the All Blacks, the crossfield kick from DuPont, and it wasn't just the All Blacks who were counter-attacking, it was the French. I mean, that's going to be some game for Ireland in Paris.
Yeah, but you know, like all this attacking rugby, and then we'll come to the Six Nations, first game in February, it'll probably be snowing, there'll be box kicking left, right and centre, both forwards will be knocking lumps out of each other. I can just picture it already. I hope I'm wrong, of course, but there's just plenty of flair with this French side, and if Ireland keep up the way they're playing, I'm sure that'll be a right tussle come the Six Nations. And yeah, just to go back on one of your earlier points about the style of rugby that Ireland are playing, and the All Blacks seem to be playing in England at certain times, and you know, Japan, the way we've watched them over the last few years, especially in the 2019 Rugby World Cup, it is refreshing. It is a breath of fresh air. Is this the way the game is going to be taken forward? As a spectacle, absolutely. I hope it is. But, you know, international rugby is all about grinding out and winning test matches. And when it comes to the crunch, we've watched South Africa do it in World Cups and in big games. You know, it's a contact sport, and one of those collisions is paramount to getting victory. So we'll see how it pans out, Ruby. But at the minute, rugby feels in a very, very good spot.
It most certainly does. Stephen Ferris, thanks for taking our call. We'll be back after the break to discuss the weekend's racing.
Game on UFM with Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on racing.
And we are going to finish the program this evening by reflecting on the racing weekend. Ruby, will we start yesterday at Navan or Saturday at Goran Park?
I'd say we'll start Saturday in Haydock Park, where the performance of the weekend came, Damien, and that was from a Plutar. Henry de Bromhead's Gold Cup runner-up absolutely hosed up in the Betfair Chase under Rachel Blackmore. It was her ninth Grade 1 victory of the year. We're lucky enough that Henry's going to take a call from us tomorrow night. Looking forward to Eclat Derrida at the weekend and Honeysuckle, of course, at Ferry House. But, you know, Henry's horses had been a little in and out, and it was a big day for him. Saturday at midday, Bob Olinger made his debut over fences. Darragh O'Keefe obviously rode him because Rachel was at Haydock, and he made a pleasing start. So, yeah, big weekend for Henry. He's going to come on tomorrow night, but a Plutar was brilliant.
What sort of an impact does that have on a yard when things haven't necessarily been going well? Like, the horse doesn't know that the form line hasn't been strong over the last couple of weeks, but will there be an additional pep in the step when people turn up to work this morning?
Definitely, and it will ease the tension around the place, no doubt, as well. But look, you imagine a team of horses in the yard like Henry's, like all racehorse trainers, they're coming along at the same time. So they would come in off the grass at the same time, Damien. So they'd be all at the same sort of standard of fitness. They'd be working together like a squad, any squad of for a football team or rugby team, anything. So, you know, obviously Manila Indo was undercooked in Down Royal. That was 3 weeks ago. But a Plutar looked absolutely spot on Saturday. And it was one heck of a performance. And you'd love the way he seemed to be changing gears all the way down the straight, going quicker and quicker at the end of a 3 mile contest.
Okay, big card as well at Ascot to reflect on.
Yeah, it was. And Nicky Henderson's buzz, I'd say he kind of threw the cat amongst the pigeons, but he's definitely left Nicky Henderson with a decision to make. He won the Ascot hurdle under Nico de Boinville. He was a winner of the Cesara Witcher back in Newmarket in early October. But does Nicky Henderson drop him back to take on Epitant and then Honeysuckle in the champion hurdle, or does he step him up and trip and go the stairs hurdle route with him? Now, ultimately, his aim will probably be the 2.5 mile hurdle at Aintree that he was second in last year, Dabracadabra. But Buzz was really impressive at the weekend, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that he could become a champion hurdle contender.
It's amazing, like the focus on Cheltenham and everything, it's firmly up and running at this stage, isn't it? Like it's
where the season builds to, but I suppose it's different to most other sports, Damien. You have to win every game or the majority of games to win the Premier League. So to be champion trainer, you have to have winners the whole time. But for each horse, that is where the biggest targets are. They're all in the spring of the year. So it's more like a cup final where you're building through every round to get to where you want to be.
Yeah, and like unbelievable return to for Gordon Elliott yesterday as well at Navan.
Yeah, spectacular. And his horses have been in incredible form since he came back from his suspension. Run Wild Fred gave Gordon his fifth highest or Tritown chase yesterday at Navan. Led home a 1-2. Fartlass was second. Big win for Davy Russell as well. I mean, Davy spent 12 months on the sidelines with a broken neck. And to come back, he's 42 years of age. You wouldn't think he was missing for 3 weeks watching him riding. You wouldn't think he was missing at all. Sorry, you wouldn't think he was... I'm kind of relate 3 weeks to a year, if you know what I mean. He's at the top of his game. Hollow Games won the Monksfield Novice Hurdle as well, and he looked a real horse for the future. The way he jumped, it was a slowly run race, and he was able to sprint down the straight to beat inferior opposition, but he showed a lot more speed than people probably thought he had, and he ran in the colours of Bective Stud, of Noel and Valerie Moore, which are becoming huge supporters of Gordon Elliott's yard. So it's exciting times for all of them.
Okay, we've nearly come to the end. We didn't get a chance to chat about it earlier. You were a fan of Solskjaer's interview yesterday, whereas I found it a bit embarrassing.
Yeah, I wasn't. When you were sacked from a job, he could have just headed off to Norway and hidden.
Yeah.
He could have. You know, and that's what some people would have done. I thought he just came out. Look, he was proud of the job he did. He probably didn't achieve as much as he wanted to achieve. Some people would say it was fake. But I thought he conducted himself with impeccable manners. It was MUTV. But at least he went and spoke to somebody. Yeah. He could have sulked off into the distance and never looked back.
Yeah, maybe it shows the emotional attachment. So tomorrow night, the Michael Carrick era begins at 5:45 tomorrow. Updates on that tomorrow. And Henry de Bromhead, as Ruby mentioned. Good to talk to you as always.
Cheers, Damien. Tara Kumar is next, I think, is she?
Yes, she is indeed. Yeah, thanks to Charlotte, was our broadcast coordinator tonight. Ronan Lawler produced the programme. From all of us here tonight.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm's on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected Tesco's nationwide.